and widening the gap between the two people in both sides. This is the only lesson, this is the only outcome of this invasion. Nothing else. Anyone who is saying anything else apart from that, he is lying. Military ways proved its failure. We should look for other ways to give each other its rights. We don't want to speak about peace. Peace is...
Hang on a moment. Something strange happened. We'll be back with you soon. This is KBOO FM, Portland.
On Friday, March 20th, 6 to 7 p.m., Bread and Roses reflects on an incredible but true story of rebellion. Tired of government propaganda, thousands of women occupied a major TV station and began broadcasting their own programs. Angered by cuts to education, tens of thousands took to the streets to protect and support striking teachers. On Friday, March 20th, Bread and Roses reflects on this true story of a teachers' rebellion in Mexico. We'll hear from the women who took over the TV station and perspectives from a renowned filmmaker who has documented people's protests around the world, featuring music by Oaxaca native Lila Downs. That's Teachers' Rebellion, Friday, March 20th, 6 to 7 p.m. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peaceworks, presenting the 25th annual Give Peace a Dance benefit concert and auction, Saturday, April 11th, 6 p.m. at the Grand Ballroom in downtown Salem, with music by Linda Hornbuckle, Kate Sullivan, Jenna Summer-Smith, and political satire by Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show. Appetizers and desserts included, silent and oral auctions, and bar. Tickets at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.org.
And partnership, that's what we should look for.
Dr. Abu Elaish, Palestinian gynecologist and peace advocate. He was speaking with Democracy Now! Producer Anjali Kamat and Jackie Suin of Big Noise Films, who both visited him in his home in Jabalia, Gaza, where Israeli shells killed three of his daughters and a niece 2 months ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back from our break, we'll talk about what's happening now, not only in Haiti, but in the United States, why many people are gathering in New York outside the Federal Immigration Center to protest the threatened deportation of 30,000 Haitians living here. Stay with us.
Yeah.
on here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, Haitian organizations are calling for a demonstration today outside the offices of Immigration and Customs Enforcement here in New York. They are calling on the Obama administration to immediately grant temporary protected status to the 30,000 undocumented Haitians in the United States who are currently threatened with deportation back to Haiti. Earlier this year, the Bush administration refused to grant Haitians the status, which allows them to live and work legally in the country. The request was made to delay the deportations until Haiti recovers from a string of deadly summer storms.
Meanwhile, in Haiti, a U.N. Security Council delegation recently praised the party of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide for fighting to overturn the disqualification of its Senate candidates. The Haitian government had barred members of the Lavalas party from running in next month's Senate elections for largely technical reasons. The ruling came days before the fifth anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup that led to Aristide's ouster. Several thousand Haitians staged a protest to mark the day and to call for the return of Aristide to Haiti without conditions. Aristide has been living in exile in South Africa since 2004. We're joined now by author and activist Randall Robinson. He's the founder and past president of Trans Africa. He's currently a visiting law professor at Pennsylvania State University, the author of many books. His most recent is called An Unbroken Agony: Haiti from Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. He joins us from State College, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Randall Robinson.
Thank you.
It's very good to have you with us. On this latest news of the protests that will take place here in New York, the threatened deportation of 30,000 Haitians living here, your response?
Well, it's a matter of simple justice. There are some 560,000 people who have been named targeted for deportation. 30,000 have been given a certain priority status to be deported immediately. Those 30,000 are Haitians. We automatically protect Cubans who are in the United States without status. They automatically allowed to stay. We have granted a temporary protected status to 300,000 Nicaraguans, Hondurans, and Salvadorans. Haiti suffered devastating hurricanes in the last seasons and floods, so that sending these people back, who present no security risk to the United States, no safety risk to American communities, who are industrious workers, and targeting them in this way, it is unjust and unfair, and a conspicuous unfairness. One is hard put to see why the Department of Homeland Security would want to continue a Bush administration policy of singling out only the Haitians for this immediate deportation.
And Randall Robinson, is there any indication from your contacts that the Obama administration will be more responsive on this issue than the Bush administration has been?
Well, I'm troubled that my understanding is that the Justice Department will leave this to the Department of Homeland Security and will not intervene. I am deeply troubled by that. This is a profound unfairness and continues this this egregious discrimination against Haitians when compared with our treatment of other people who enjoy the same status in the United States. It makes absolutely no sense. The New York Times editorial page has criticized this continuation of the Bush policy, and we would invite the administration to change course and to instruct the Department of Homeland Security to grant TPS to these Haitians who are in the United States, and we would invite Americans to call the White House to do this. This will wreak havoc not only in the lives of these people, but it will wreak havoc for Haiti trying to recover from last season's devastating hurricanes.
Randall Robinson, I wanted to get your reaction to the Secretary of State's husband, to the former President Bill Clinton, in Haiti last week, along with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, to promote an anti-poverty initiative there. This is some of what former President Clinton had to say on this visit.
I have followed Haiti for more than three decades. This is the first time I have ever really believed that the country had a chance to slip the bonds of poverty and escape the heritage of oppressive government and misgovernment and abuse of people that have held people down too long.
That is former President Clinton in Haiti last week. Randall Robinson, your response.
Well, I think his approach is wrong, fundamentally wrong. He is supporting an idea, a campaign to bring in 5,000 sweatshop-type jobs. These are the kinds of jobs that leave no capital investment in the country. Haiti needs infrastructure. Haiti needs help in turning its rice bowl into a food-producing capacity that can feed 8.5 million Haitians, as it once did before the devastation, before the United States invaded Haiti and overturned the democracy headed by President Aristide. Haiti needs capital investment that leaves in the country. The kinds of jobs that President Clinton is talking about are the jobs that in which minimum wage is not protected, environmental standards are not protected, health standards are not protected, minimum wage in which the worker produces this enormous profit for investors who come in and honor no local laws and leave, and in their wake leave slums like City Soleil. That is not the kind of investment that that Haiti needs. It needs capital investment. It needs investment so that it can be self-sufficient. It needs investment so that it can feed itself. That's not the kind of investment President Clinton is talking about. He's talking about investment that overwhelmingly favors the interest of those businesses who want to invest in Haiti only because its labor is desperate and very cheap.
And how would you assess the role that the United Nations has played in these past years when there were UN-authorized troops in Haiti in terms of being able to help the country be able to progress and get out of the spiral of violence that followed the second overthrow of President Aristide?
Well, I'm distressed to say not very helpful. When we intervened in Haiti, when 30 American special forces went to the president's home on February the 29th, 2004, and kidnapped the president and his American-born wife and secreted them off to the Central African Republic, we violated several international laws. We violated the United Nations Charter. And keeping the president out of the country now, at the behest of the United States, violates the treaty, the International Covenant on Civil and the Protection of Civil and Political Rights. All people have a right by law, and we're party to this convention, to return to their own country. They cannot be barred from that. And so the UN has not stood up against us on this. And so it has become a party. The Caribbean nations ask for an investigation of what happened, into what happened to Haiti's democracy. And the U.S. On the Security Council squelched that. You cannot abide these kinds of egregious violations of international law and still have the sort of human rights project in the world are respected by all.
Rhonda Robinson, as you talk about this fifth anniversary of the second coup against President Aristide, I wanted to go back to that time. I saw you then. We went on that small plane from Florida halfway around the world through to the Central African Republic, where he had been, well, basically dumped with the First Lady of Haiti, Mildred Aristide. It was a remarkable trip. And on the way back, when this delegation led by you, Randall Robinson, founder of TransAfrica, Maxine Waters, Congress member from Los Angeles, leading a small group of people to really take on the U.S. government, call the bluff of the government, say, if President Aristide is free to go, then we want to come and take him back. And I wanted to play a clip of when I interviewed President Aristide as we're coming back on the plane over the Atlantic, just days after his ouster as president, what President Aristide at the time had to say.
Those who want to invest in killing democracy, in bloodshed, they don't accept you as an elected president. We had 32 coup d'etat plus the last one, 33, in our 200 years of independence. Our goal was to move not from coup d'etat to coup d'etat anymore, but from elections to elections, free, fair, and democratic elections. That wasn't the goal. They went back to coup d'etat.
And here is what President Aristide said when I asked him whether he had actually resigned from office as the Bush administration had contended.
I didn't resign. What some people call resignation is a new coup d'etat or a modern kidnapping.
He said it was a modern kidnapping. He said it was a coup that was backed by the United States. Randall Robinson, this is 5 years later, just after the fifth anniversary. There is a new president in the United States, the first black president in the United States. I'm wondering your thoughts on what you feel he should be doing with the first black republic in the Western world, Haiti, born in 1804.
Well, first, he has to stop American interference in the democratic process of Haiti. And I trust that he will do that. He has to make sure that Lavalas, the country's largest party, can participate in the political process. He has to make sure that the tens of thousands of people who have demonstrated for President Aristide's return will see their leader come home to them. That's the democratic process. We're not asking the president to do anything but to be just and to ensure that democracy will survive and flourish in Haiti. That means that the Haitian people will get to choose their own president. President Aristide was really banished from Haiti because he fought to have the minimum wage raised to $2 a day. And that offended the interest of the business community and foreign investors, the kinds of investments and investors that President Clinton is encouraging in this case, with 5,000 assembly workers or sweatshop workers. That's not the kind of investment we need. We need a just society. We need a democratic society. We need a society in which the Haitian people will get to choose the leadership that they want, not the leadership necessarily that we want.
And Randall Robinson, we've covered here on Democracy Now! The enormous changes that have occurred in the southern part of the hemisphere in recent years, with so many populist governments coming to power in various parts of Latin America. Your sense of how this has impacted on Haiti's political development and whether the prospects are for increasing radicalization or unity among the Haitian people?
We have to understand that Since the Reagan years, there has been an enormous transfer of wealth in the world. We live in a world now where 1% of the world's people control 40% of the world's wealth. The United States alone controls 32% of the world's wealth. And so the poor have gotten poorer and more numerous, and the rich have gotten richer. And so there is a great deal of suffering in the world because of that. And when we foreclose to people the opportunity to ease their pain and continue to cultivate and profit from exploitation, we will get a blowback from that. And that's happening in Latin America, a lot of it expressed in anger towards the United States and the actions we have often committed gratuitously, needlessly making enemies that we don't have to have. Haiti and the Caribbean countries want to be friends of the United States, but it means that we have to have some kind of just reciprocity in trade, in diplomacy, and in the spirit of the United Nations Charter. In the spirit of human rights, in the spirit of all of the human rights treaties that have been embraced by the world, to raise the poor and to give them a path to a just and fair life.
And changing topics, I'd like to ask you about the upcoming United Nations conference on racism and the position of the Obama administration that it did not want the discussion of reparations or of the Israeli-Palestinian situation at the conference. You've been a long proponent of raising the issue of reparations in this country. Your reaction?
Well, I don't think the principal impediment was the reparations issue. I think the principal impediment was the issue of Israel. I'm saddened by the decision that has been made by the administration. We should never be afraid to discuss ideas. When our ideas are defensible and strong, they will fare well, and we ought to always be willing to participate in discussion. Some believe that it would be an Israel bashing occasion. I don't believe that, but one has to accept that there has been a consensus developed in the world, joined in by friends of Israel, traditional friends, and traditional critics from all over the world, that what happened in Gaza, the indiscriminate killing of over 1,000 men, women, and children, the destruction of Gaza wholesale, constituted an act that was morally repugnant. And one shouldn't shrink from making an observation that is fair and honest. And that would be discussed. And I don't think the United States should not engage in a discussion in which criticism is raised against any country. We ought to be prepared to exchange our views. So I'm unhappy about the United States' decision not to participate in the Geneva meeting in April. I think we should. If we have ideas that are defensible, we ought to present them and exchange with others and listen to what the responses are.
Randall Robinson, we'll have to leave it there. We thank you for being with us, author of An Unbroken Agony. I'm Amy Goodman Gonzalez. I'll be in Grand Rapids tonight. Thanks for joining us.
KPLO FM program. Power to the people.
On Friday, March 20th, 6 to 7 p.m., Bread and Roses reflects on an incredible but true story of rebellion. Tired of government propaganda, thousands of women occupied a major TV station and began broadcasting their own programs. Angered by cuts to education, tens of thousands took to the streets to protect and support striking teachers. On Friday, March 20th, Bread and Roses reflects on this true story of a teacher's rebellion in Mexico. We'll hear from the women who took over the TV station and perspectives from a renowned filmmaker who has documented people's protests around the world, featuring music by Oaxaca native Lila Downs. That's Teachers' Rebellion, Friday, March 20th, 6 to 7 p.m.
I'm Lena Aliolora.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a federal judge agrees that Blackwater can be sued for botched operations in Iraq.
Vermont moves one step closer to again allowing gay marriage.
New videos are released showing Tibetan protesters being beaten and tortured by Chinese police.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, March 20th, 2009. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. This coming Wednesday, the Portland City Council will consider a proposal to replace the city's open reservoir system with a closed one. Floyd Jones, a community activist with Friends of the Reservoirs, says that the proposal is a thinly veiled plan to funnel the city's money into corporate profits.
In the end, all of these projects, whether you're talking about building an additional Bull Run treatment plant, unnecessarily building a treatment plant, and unnecessarily burying reservoirs, of course the beneficiaries are the corporations. Good water management is a result of good operations and good maintenance of your system. But those projects, you know, don't benefit corporations. Only building projects benefit corporations. And as a matter of fact, there were several corporations involved in the development of this negotiated regulation. This regulation was a negotiated regulation, and both Montgomery Watson Harza and Calgon Carbon were involved in the development of this regulation. Montgomery Watson Harza builds treatment plants; they bury reservoirs. Calgon Carbon held a patent for the technology that most systems will be using to comply with the source water aspect of the rule, the ultraviolet light radiation. They held a patent for that. So, yes, these $800 million worth of projects with no measurable public health benefit will benefit the corporations. And they were beneficiaries along the way, as a matter of fact, because they all had, many of them had contracts for design for treatment plants and design for burial of reservoirs along the way.
That was Floyd Jones with Friends of the Reservoirs in Portland. The city council hearing on the reservoir proposal will take place on Wednesday, March 25th at 2:30 in the afternoon. Liam.
A bill passed by the Washington State Senate will prevent inmates from using public records laws to intimidate or harass people. The state lawyers who handle public records litigation say the legislation would dramatically cut the amount of time they spend on frivolous or intimidating requests. Last year, the department received more than 11,000 public record requests. 8,000 of those came from inmates. This marks a 64% jump from 2007. The majority of those requests are legitimate, but there are a few prisoners who abuse the system in order to harass employees. The Washington Coalition for Open Government is concerned that the measure could lead to restrictions on access to public records for anyone, not just prisoners.
The Congressional Budget Office says it predicts the U.S. deficit this year will be much higher than originally thought and will reach more than $1.8 trillion. And the U.S. is on track to remain in the red over the next 10 years. According to figures released by the Budget Office today, President Barack Obama's proposed budget will increase the deficit by approximately $1 trillion a year, and the last time the government had a balanced budget was under Bill Clinton in 1996. The budget includes increased spending on health care and green energy and might make passage of President Obama's first budget more challenging.
President Obama announced guidelines today aimed at limiting the influence lobbyists will have in carrying out the economic stimulus program. Mr. Obama told state legislators gathered at the White House that decisions about how money will be spent will be based on the merits, creating the most jobs and helping reverse the recession. The president said his administration would post on the Internet all requests by lobbyists who want to talk to members of the administration about projects that involve using the money from the Economic Recovery Act. All requests must be in writing, and details from meetings between the administration and lobbyists about stimulus projects will also be posted online.
Today, a federal judge decided that a lawsuit blaming the Army Corps of Engineers for heavy flooding from Hurricane Katrina can proceed. The lawsuit claims that the Army Corps failed to maintain an important navigation channel, allowing Katrina's surge to swamp eastern New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish. The decision clears the way for a trial, sure to be watched by thousands of others with pending flood claims.
A Vermont State Senate committee unanimously approved a gay marriage bill today. The state is now one step closer to joining Massachusetts and Connecticut as the only U.S. states allowing gays and lesbians to legally marry. One sponsor of the bill said that it, quote, provides gay and lesbian couples the same rights that I have as a married heterosexual. Vermont's governor opposes the bill, but he won't say if he'll veto it should the bill reach his desk.
Military contractors working abroad have been under investigation in criminal trials for years. However, because of a Virginia court ruling this week, they will also be accountable in civil trials. FSRN's Sam Greenspan reports.
In a federal court decision issued late on Wednesday, a judge said that the fog of war will not protect military contractor Kaki, spelled C-A-C-I. The court ruled a tort case brought by four Iraqi civilians can proceed. The men say they were detained, tortured, and eventually released from Abu Ghraib prison without ever being charged for a crime. Catherine Gallagher, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, is representing the four Iraqi plaintiffs. She says this ruling indicates that several other outstanding tort cases against Kaki and military contractor Blackwater will likely move forward as well.
Wednesday's ruling has large ramifications for all of these cases, particularly when many of the contractors are raising the same arguments that they are immune or they share some form of the immunity of the government or the fact that they're working in a, quote, combat zone. This decision really breaks down that argument very, very strongly, saying, no, you're contractors, you're working in Iraq for profit, and you are not the government.
In their civil lawsuit, plaintiffs are seeking damages for physical and mental abuse. But Gallagher says that monetary gains are only part of what the Iraqi victims and their families want.
The first thing that victims of torture and abuse are looking for is some validation of what happened to them. So to have a United States court recognize that they were in fact tortured and abused will be a big part of the victory for them. And shedding light on what happened to them so that it never happens again is also part of their quest for justice.
Because the Virginia court is in the same legal circuit as at least two other ongoing tort cases against war contractors, this ruling will be binding in those suits as well. Sam Greenspan, FSRN, Washington.
The Pentagon has released its latest report on sexual assault by members of the U.S. military. Reported incidents are up 8% across the board, and nearly 25% in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon says that's a good thing. It means more victims are reporting assaults. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has the story.
Anne Wright served in the military for 29 years. She says being a woman in the military has always been hard.
Innuendos, comments. You women, you can't keep up with anyone. They shouldn't have women in here. You can't run as fast as I can. You can't push as many weights up as I can. We're, the military is much weaker because you're a part of it. Everything from that to, you know, if you don't sleep with me, you're a lesbian.
The Department of Defense has to report every year on sexual assault in the military. And every year, no matter what the numbers say, they find a way to claim that it's really good news. This year, they're cheering the 26% increase in sexual assaults among women in Iraq and Afghanistan, and an 8% increase across the entire military establishment.
You know, they've achieved a victory in that. This year, a greater number of cases have been reported.
Rachel Nadelson directs the Veterans and Service Members Project at the Urban Justice Center.
Which is kind of funny because, you know, in years past, they've also declared victory when the numbers of cases have gone down, and the response having been, well, you know, we can pat ourselves on the back because the numbers are dipping.
The Pentagon says that nearly 3,000 sexual assaults were reported in 2008, and they estimate that 80% of sexual assaults go unreported. Even with such a low rate of reporting, the numbers show that women in the military run twice the risk of being assaulted as their civilian counterparts. Anuradha Bhagwati was a captain in the Marine Corps from 1999 to 2004. She experienced repeated sexual harassment from a junior officer.
I was the chain of command.
When the commander refused to do anything about it, Captain Bhagwati took the complaint to the Equal Opportunity Office, which can investigate but not prosecute cases. She says going off base without the support of her senior officers was the most frightening thing she's ever had to do.
You know, I just completely broke down in their office. I had no idea, you know, what kind of stress I was under because I feared going back to work. And there's no, yeah, that's another thing. If you can't just quit your job, you can't just leave your unit. You have to work with the people who are messing your life up. You know, you have to work with the people who are either harassing, assaulting, or raping you.
Though the Equal Opportunity Office's investigation substantiated Bhagwati's claims against the lieutenant, the case never went to court-martial.
The school commander promoted the lieutenant during the investigation to captain. He didn't even wait to see what the EO people would say. He was given command of a company, which included, again, hundreds of 17- and 18-year-old women and several female staff members.
Bhagwati says all equal opportunity case files are destroyed 2 years after they're created. She wanted to file a grievance against her commander, who had refused to deal with the issue, but she couldn't bring herself to do it.
So he acted basically as criminally negligent because he allowed all of this to happen under his command without punishing the lieutenant. In part, I was perhaps at fault too because I didn't take my lieutenant colonel down, but it's something I could not do. I mean, I would have been terrified for my life. I don't know what they're capable of. You know, once you start getting threatened for talking out, it's pretty crazy.
She quit the Marines and started seeing a military sexual trauma counselor for post-traumatic stress disorder. Eventually, she helped start a campaign for military victims of sexual trauma at the Service Women's Action Network.
You know, I just wanted to leave the Marines at that point. I mean, I had it. You know, I was going to be a career officer.
Sexual harassment isn't even mentioned in the Pentagon's report. Bhagwati and Wright both claim that the vast majority of women in the military experience harassment on a daily basis. Meanwhile, just 10% of sexual assault cases in the Pentagon's report resulted in the court-martial of the alleged offender. They don't report conviction rates. Rachel Nadelson.
The question that tends to get asked is, you know, how can we get the military to police itself better? But nobody seems to ever ask the question of why we're still letting the military police itself.
The military, unique among government agencies, is immune to external review. A victim of sexual assault and harassment, once she has exhausted her options up the chain of command, has no options left. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, the U.S. military has confirmed that 4,258 soldiers have been killed in Iraq since the invasion began in 2003. As for Iraqi casualties, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. The exact number of Iraqi civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight's program explores the amazing but true story of a teacher's rebellion in Oaxaca, Mexico, that turned into a massive social justice movement. Tomorrow's weather is a 50% chance of rain with thunderstorms, possible also early Saturday morning. Some of the storms could produce small hail, mostly cloudy with a high near 54.
It's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The most amazing thing to me about Robert Holding, a milkman in Lancashire, England, is not that he was delivering little packets of marijuana to a few of his elderly customers along his milk route, but that the Brits can actually still get home delivery of milk. Imagine, our National Postal Service says it can't even keep delivering our mail to us 6 days a week, and here's a 72-year-old milkman still schlepping pints of cow juice door to door each day. It was his little side business, however, that prompted British authorities to crack down on Holding. It seems that he would also drop off small bits of cannabis to 17 of his clients who requested the extra service. They were old, he said, and had aches and pains. The customers, who were pensioners ranging up to 92 years of age, would leave little notes on their stoops alongside their empty bottles asking, "Can I have an ounce?" Holding, who sold the stuff on the cheap side and apparently was not raking off much of a profit, felt he was doing a public service for the old folks. They enjoyed it, he says. They saved a lot of money while I was doing it, and I only did it for a short time. Indeed, after only 6 months as a dealer, our Lancashire milkman was ratted out by someone. British bobbies raided Holding's home, found 6 ounces of the dreaded weed, and arrested him. Alas, while England's marijuana laws are not quite as insane as ours, they're still unforgiving, so he was sentenced to 36 weeks in prison and given a stern lecture about the harm he has been doing by spreading marijuana to the old folks. However, after the scolding, the judge noted that Holding's wife has Alzheimer's disease and that he visits her every day in the nursing home. Thus, the jail time was suspended, provided, of course, that he delivers nothing but milk. This is Jim Hightower saying, imagine the disappointment of his customers.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Argentina faces another farmer strike and blockade in a dispute over export taxes. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Infuriated by the government's decision to uphold a steep export tax on soy, farmers set up barricades along major highways, blocking big rig trucks and local traffic in several provinces. Sparking even more tension with farmers, President Cristina Kirchner yesterday agreed to share tax revenues with local governments. Before, all funds went to the national government. Farmers are threatening a 10-day strike if the tax is not revoked. The conflict over the soy tax began last year when the government raised the tax to 35%. Being the world's third largest producer and exporter of soy, revenues from the cash crop have been a major source of income for Argentina. In recent months, soy farmers have been hit hard by the drastic global drop in the price of food commodities and a severe drought. The agricultural sector has led a growing dissatisfaction with the national government, which has announced early legislative elections due to pressures from the opposition. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Portland peace activist Sarah Farahat is currently in the Palestinian territories on a peace delegation. She brings us this report of a nonviolent protest held today near Bethlehem.
Today we participated with a group from Bethlehem and Beit Zahur who every Friday go to protest the wall. They're not allowed to come up to, this time we were protesting, they were trying to walk up to where there was a settlement within the West Bank, and the Israeli Defense Forces had barbed wired the area off. And this is in honor of Mother's Day, which is tomorrow, and so this march in solidarity with all of the mothers who, as in the words of one man at the protest, have suffered the most from the occupation.
That was Sarah Farahat of Portland reporting from the Palestinian West Bank.
A number of other nonviolent protests were held in Palestine today, including in the town of Belleine, where American peace activist and indie media reporter Tristan Anderson was critically injured by Israeli forces in a protest last week. Mary Arthur with the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem has more.
The residents of Bilin village, located near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, marched towards the wall on Friday after midday prayers. The protest was joined by Israeli and international activists. Protesters carried a huge banner condemning Israel's ongoing policies and violence against civilians, especially in Jerusalem. The protest began in the centre of the village, called for national unity and resistance to the occupation, then headed towards the apartheid wall, which is built on Bilin's land. An Israeli army unit stationed behind the wall prevented the crowd from going through the gate. The army fired tear gas canisters to break up the crowd, causing dozens to suffer gas inhalation. At least three demonstrators were injured in the weekly protest, including two from the United States. Also near Ramallah on Friday, scores of villagers from Nilin held their weekly protest on Friday midday against the illegal Israeli wall being built on village land. Along with international and Israeli solidarity workers, villagers marched towards the land which is being confiscated by Israel to build the wall. Demonstrators carried banners in support of the American supporter, Tristan Anderson, who was critically wounded in last week's protest. Anderson is still at an Israeli hospital receiving treatment. Doctors are currently saying that he will live, but with severe disabilities resulting from the injury to his head. As soon as locals and international supporters arrived in that part of the village where Israel is building the wall, soldiers showered them with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets, also firing live rounds of ammunition. Six were injured, one critically, when he was hit in the head by a rubber-coated steel bullet. Dozens were treated for gas inhalation. For IMEMC.org, this is Mary Arthur.
On the diplomatic front in Palestine, representatives of more than a dozen Palestinian factions, including rival Hamas and Fatah parties, returned from Cairo today for a break following an unsuccessful first try at forming a unity government. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has details.
Palestinians involved in the unity talks say that the main obstacle to forming a power-sharing government are continuing disagreements between Hamas and Fatah. Hamas wants to form a transitional conciliation government that will decide on a platform after it takes power. Fatah wants the details of the government worked out in advance. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department issued a statement yesterday objecting to any Palestinian government that does not meet the three international demands: recognizing Israel, accepting previous agreements with the country, and renouncing violence. Unity talks are expected to resume by the end of March. Any conciliation government that comes out of the talks will hold power until elections, which are scheduled for January 2010. In another news, a UN human rights investigator says Israel did not adequately distinguish between military and civilian targets during its January attack on Gaza, and this could constitute a serious war crime. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
The Israeli military advocate general has called for criminal inquiries into the conduct of Israeli troops in Gaza. The request came in response to soldiers' testimonies that describe loose rules of engagement, troops firing on unarmed civilians, and troops intentionally vandalizing property during the three-week assault on Gaza. On Thursday, the Israeli online Haaretz published testimonies of Israeli soldiers who took part in the Israeli Cast Lead offensive in Gaza. Operation Cast Lead started on December 27, 2008, and ended 22 days later, leaving 1,400 Palestinians killed and at least 7,000 injured. This report is the first of its kind since it contravenes with Israeli army reports that the soldiers behaved with a, quote, high level of morals during the attack.
Newly released video of Chinese police beating Tibetan demonstrators in 2008 shows a never-before-seen level of brutality by the Chinese authorities. KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Ladon Tetong, Executive Director of Students for a Free Tibet.
Could you talk about the newly released footage of the beatings in Lhasa in 2008?
Sure, yeah. We were just, it was actually amazing to see this footage come out today, released by the Dalai Lama's government, the Tibetan government in exile in India. And it's footage they've received, three different pieces of footage that show Tibetans just being brutally beaten a whole group of Tibetans with their hands tied behind their backs, both lay people, monks, nuns, it looks like. It's just sort of a chaotic scene of what must have been sort of the middle of the protest or just after the protest, and they're being dragged around and just beaten, and you can barely, I could barely watch the footage. And this is the only footage that we've seen come out from inside Tibet, because the Chinese authorities have sealed Tibet off, and really they've been doing everything in their power to stop exactly this kind of image from making it to the outside world.
And can you talk specifically about the case of Tendar? The footage has come out of him, and I understand that he died during that time as well.
Yeah, the second part of the footage shows this young man, Tendar, and it seems like what happened with him was on March 14th. He was on his way to the office, and he saw what was a common sight at that time, the police beating a monk, one single monk, and he went to intervene, and he ended up being beaten, tortured, obviously arrested or imprisoned or something, and so severely, severely beaten and tortured that the footage they have, and I just can't believe they even got this out, they show his body, and it's really extremely graphic, his body, which has been tortured. His foot has had, you know, a nail driven through it, and I guess the wounds, because he wasn't given proper medical attention, the wounds festered and became infected, and the report is very gruesome that he essentially had, like, you know, I think a quarter of his body weight removed as doctors tried to, in the end, save him after months of not being, or a month of not being treated or cared for properly. And you literally see him, signs of torture on his body, and he's festering wounds as they're trying to save this man who looks like a shell of his former self, and then he dies. The footage must have been, you know, some family member or somebody just desperate to have the world, have the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan government in exile in India, see what had been done to that young man who was guilty of nothing more than trying to prevent harm, you know, from coming to a Tibetan monk.
And can you just talk about what does it take to get these tapes out? Are people actually sneaking these videos over the mountains into India in order to get them released?
That is correct. I mean, that would be my guess from the quality of this footage. It can't be, you know, sometimes it's possible for people to get images and video out over the Internet, but the Chinese have even locked a lot of that down and shut Internet and phone communications off. If you get caught passing information, if any Tibetan gets caught passing information to the outside world of what's truly happening in Tibet, even talking on the phone, which they monitor very strictly, you can end up in prison. One young Tibetan woman, just 31 years old, was sentenced to 5 years in prison in November simply for telling somebody on the phone what was happening inside, because, of course, the world was dying to know and China won't let anybody see. And I think for us, this is the point. If the Chinese government says Tibetans are happy, if they say everybody is fine and there's no problem in there, then let the world see. Let the media in. Let independent observers in. You know, they say it's our word against theirs. Well, all we're saying at this point is if you open Tibet up wide to the world, if there's nothing to hide there, then show us what's happening. Of course, China is spinning lie after lie after lie about what's really happening in Tibet.
Well, I just want to thank you for joining us today. Again, I've been speaking with Ladon Tetong, the Executive Director of Students for a Free Tibet. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dane Gatewood, Kyle Burris, and Ben Fulton. Special thanks to reporter Sarah Faharat, our engineers Jeff Lovell, the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott interviews Diana Butler Bass, author of A People's History of Christianity, about Christianity and social justice work. Diana Butler Bass is an author, speaker, and independent scholar specializing in religion and culture in America. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the Movie Moles review the film Che. Laurie Mercier discusses the AIG bonuses. And Bill Resnick interviews Fred McKissick of Rethinking Schools about merit pay and teacher motivations. At 10, headlines and commentary on Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and myself. At 10:15, If You Love This Planet. The guest is anti-nuclear activist Mary Olson of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. She talks about the nuclear renaissance in the U.S., including the push for the flawed Generation 4 reactors. At 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, four healthcare advocates talk about the Oregon State Legislature. Representatives of the Archimedes Movement, Healthcare for All Oregon, Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates, and Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. At 11:30, Web of Life, a program looking at animals and how they're treated in our society. And now stay tuned for Counterspin. Good night, Annalisa.
Good night, Liam.
You're listening to KBOO-FM in Portland, and we'd like to apologize again for the glitch during Democracy Now!, and we'll try to pull the end of the interview with Izzaddin Abu Aish and play that for you a little later. Now, stay tuned for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the AIG executive bonuses account for less than 1% of the money taxpayers are turning over to the insurance giant in the largest of the corporate bailouts. But it's the bonus story that has riveted the public attention and outrage. We'll talk to Robert Johnson, former managing director at Soros Funds Management and former chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee, about the power of the bonuses story. Also on the show, CNN has been telling viewers that regardless of where you are in the country, that's this country, the war among Mexican drug cartels is a threat to you. How real is the recent round of scare stories about Mexico and the drug war, and what interests are served by it? We'll hear from Laura Carlson of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
In the March 4th Washington Post, reporter Scott Wilson chided Barack Obama for saying that he inherited problems from his predecessor, George Bush. According to Wilson, this could be dangerous. Blaming his predecessor holds what Wilson calls special risks because Obama's candidacy was built on, quote, a promise to rise above Washington's divisive partisan traditions, winning over many independent voters and moderate Republicans in the process, close quote. So it's not that Obama's claim is untrue. It's just that mentioning it, telling the truth, risks losing support outside his Democratic base, which he needs to get his current legislation passed. But Wilson also writes, quote, upon entering the White House in 2001, Bush pinned the lackluster economy on his predecessor using the Clinton recession to successfully argue in favor of tax cuts that won some Democratic support, close quote. So when Bush blamed Clinton for his economic situation, he successfully gained Democratic support for his policies. But for Obama, blaming his predecessor incurs special risks, which could cost him Republican support. One could read Wilson as saying there are special risks because Obama promised to rise above Washington's divisive partisan traditions. But so did Bush. Remember, I'm a uniter, not a divider? Whatever the case, if you can't see why criticizing the previous president should gain support for Bush but cost Obama support, then you might not have what it takes to be a big league Washington journalist.
Those big league journalists treat U.S. intelligence agencies with solemn reverence when they reinforce official views about American enemies and friends. This is true even when those agencies dupe reporters again and again. But stray from the nationalist straight and narrow, and the same intelligence sources risk becoming invisible in the press, perhaps even suspicious. This model goes some way in explaining why major media outlets continue to report without question Barack Obama's and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's claims that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. For instance, Secretary Clinton didn't get so much as a raised eyebrow when she told ABC's Charlie Gibson that, quote, Iran's pursuit of the nuclear weapon is deeply troubling to not only the U.S., but many people throughout the world, close quote. Why should this claim be challenged? Because the administration's own Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, says it's not true. As Blair told the Senate Intelligence Committee on March 10th, quote, the overall situation, and the intelligence community agrees on this, is that Iran has not decided to press forward to have a nuclear weapon on top of a ballistic missile, close quote. It would be simple for journalists at major media outlets with official access to ask why the president and the secretary of state are making claims that U.S. intelligence can't back up. But even after all the confessions and mea culpas, the damage resulting from other instances when they failed to challenge officials, many journalists apparently still haven't learned the lesson.
Conservative columnist George Will came to the defense of business reporters on ABC's This Week on March 15th. Said Will, quote, I think the best journalism in America is business journalism precisely because they deal with real metrics. You can actually, they know things, close quote. So they know things, unlike scientists, apparently, since Will has repeatedly suggested that scientists don't know very much about global warming. Well, one would think, though, that business reporters as a group have spent the last decade or so demonstrating that they don't know much about the economy, first failing to notice that the stock market's tech boom was a bubble that was bound to pop, and then cheerleading as housing prices rose to similarly unsustainable levels. But Will isn't the only one defending such coverage, fellow Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen had a piece on March 17th attacking The Daily Show's Jon Stewart for his cheap shot at business media. Cohen was referring to Stewart's March 12th grilling of CNBC's Jim Cramer, whom Stewart had accused of knowing about financial shenanigans and helping to cover them up. Cohen's response was that financial bigwigs had lost money they had invested in their own companies, and Cohen himself had lost money betting on AIG. So how could Cramer have possibly known that anything was amiss? Well, there was this quote that The Daily Show found from Cramer's October 31st, 2007 show.
You should be buying things and accept that they're overvalued, but accept that they're going to keep going higher. I know that sounds irresponsible, but that's how you make the money.
Cramer knows things all right. It's just that many of them are wrong.
We've noted a rise in media stories that find a new empathy for economic hardships when they're faced by better-off folks. There's a sense in some of these pieces that the troubles are worse when the people involved aren't accustomed to facing them. Author and activist Barbara Ehrenreich reminded us recently not to let the stories about what she called the neo-suffering of the nouveau poor tempt us to believe that class inequalities are being evened out. In a March 12th blog post, Ehrenreich reminds us of the obvious enough but still overlooked fact that recessions historically increase income polarization, making things even harder for people who were struggling to begin with. So why have we heard so little, relatively, about this aspect of the recession's impact? Ehrenreich draws on her years inside journalism to conclude, quote, when a millionaire cuts back on his creme fraiche and caviar consumption, you have a touching human interest story. But pitch a story about a laid-off roofer who loses his trailer home, and you're likely to get a big editorial yawn, close quote. Poor get poorer, she says, is just not considered an eye-grabbing headline, even when the evidence is overwhelming.
And finally, there were any number of ways to report on the election of Mauricio Funes as the next president of El Salvador. The biggest news might have been that this is a victory for the left-wing FMLN party, formerly a guerrilla group during the country's brutal civil war. That political connection was what alarmed the hosts of Fox News Channel's morning show, Fox and Friends, on March 16th. First, Fox's host Steve Doocy laughed that Funes' former role as a CNN freelancer made the rival cable channel the Communist News Network, but it was deeper than that, as explained by his co-host, Peter Johnson.
The FMLN, the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front, which allegedly has ties to strongman Cesar Chavez.
Oh, great.
Not one of our great allies.
You don't mean strongman Wolf Blitzer, you mean strongman
Cesar.
Cesar. You were picking on the lettuce guy there for a second.
Poor Cesar Chavez is dead.
Hard to know what's worse, the fear-mongering about a presidential candidate being tied to another president, or the fact that it took that long for the Fox host to figure out that Cesar Chavez was not a Latin American president. He was the lettuce guy.
Thanks, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Within the next few months, insurance giant AIG will have received $200 billion in bailout funds from the U.S. government, supposedly giving taxpayers 80% ownership of the company. In a March 17th column, former New York Governor Elliot Spitzer writes, quote, "Everybody is rushing to condemn AIG's bonuses, but this simple scandal is obscuring the real disgrace at the insurance giant. Why are AIG's counterparties getting paid back in full to the tune of tens of billions of taxpayer dollars?" Close quote. Well, Spitzer's view notwithstanding, the story that has galvanized public outrage is the story of how AIG is paying out $165 million, less than 1% of the bailout funds it's received, in bonuses to its executives. Our guest is one of four leading financial analysts who have issued a joint statement calling for a halt to the bonuses and a rethinking of larger AIG issues. Formerly the managing director at Soros Funds Management and chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee, Robert Johnson also is the co-author with Thomas Ferguson of Too Big to Bail, The Paulson Put, Presidential Politics and the Global Financial Meltdown, an article that will be appearing soon in the International Journal of Political Economy. Robert Johnson, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Over the last few decades, with few exceptions, growth has gone to the wealthy, with working and middle-class workers making few gains. Do you think this current outrage is partly fueled by the fact that people see the AIG bonus story as sort of perfectly crystallizing that disparity and unfairness?
Well, as you mentioned, over the last 30 years or so, we've had very substantial gains in productivity, and about 4% of the population has gotten wealthy. And the remainder of the population has maintained their living standards through innovations in consumer credit. Now consumer credit has, let's say, exploded or imploded. It's collapsed. And those disparities are hitting home much harder. I think the bonus, what you might call bonus jealousy, is a catalyst. But I also, from your introduction, think that Elliot Spitzer's right on the money. The real scale of how the taxpayer is being hammered is the way in which we're doing a backdoor bailout through the hallways of AIG to Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, and most profoundly, Goldman Sachs.
Well, what other reasons do you think this has so galvanized the public attention?
I think because it's gone on and on for months. This is, first of all, the scale of collapse in the economy is really unprecedented for anybody that wasn't alive during the Great Depression of the 30s. Secondly, this has been going on and on without resolution. Thirdly, there is no transparency. These deals are being done on a case-by-case, ad hoc, backroom basis where the people who are paying for it, meaning the taxpayers, are told that they can't know what's going on.
Well, what should be done with AIG? What are you and Thomas Ferguson and your other two colleagues asking for?
What I would suggest is that they take AIG, Financial Products Division, separate it from the insurance business, which is probably quite healthy, reincorporate it, bankrupt AIG Financial Products, put it in a receivership, have the President of the United States announce that that does not imply that they won't continue to negotiate with various financial counterparties to make payments or reach settlement in an orderly fashion, and vis-a-vis the bonuses in particular, the declaration of bankruptcy would abrogate those contracts and they could start over and talk to people about what they were going to do that had merit or had benefits going forward.
where you talked about the contracts. Well, one of the main themes of the bonus story, one purveyed by pundits and White House figures alike, has been that the bonuses were previously written into the contracts, and the contracts are inviolable. But corporate executives and government economic advisors don't always feel that all contracts with employees are inviolable, do they?
Well, if I worked for the United Auto Workers right now, I'd have, I would say, a case in point where they didn't think the sanctity of contracts was anything to stop them from restructuring pension benefits, fringe benefits, and salaries. And someone watching Larry Summers of the White House or Secretary Geithner on television last Sunday talking about the sanctity of contracts might have been a little bit confused.
Seeing that the Obama administration knew about the bonuses beforehand, how should we look at the umbrage over the bonuses now coming from those quarters? Should we look upon it as a good thing, showing the power of public outrage to move the White House? Or should we see it as a kind of cynical damage control where the White House's corporate identified economic team was caught sort of out of touch and is now trying to mollify public outrage?
I think you should see it as both. I would say that you saw a cynical attempt to spin and manipulate the public on the part of the administration. I think they got caught. I think the outrage has, what you might call, scared them a little bit, and they are now coping and perhaps changing gears in a non-transitory manner. I've been somewhat disturbed because I've seen Walter Shapiro's article that looked like was fed to them by the administration about wacko populism, whether Father Coughlin on the right or Huey Long on the left. And I think if the administration adopts the mindset that people who are enraged right now are wackos, they are essentially acting wacko. Mainstream, God-loving, military-serving, honest citizens are outraged right now. It is not some extreme fringe that's outraged, and the outrage is valid.
Robert Johnson, what questions should journalists be asking about AIG, the bonuses, and the larger questions, and what policies that aren't under consideration in the current media discussion should be raised by journalists?
I think the key thing, and I do see some hints of that now, just in the last day or so, is why were all of these credit default swaps and other transactions paid to entities, municipal governments, foreign banks, or healthy banks like Goldman Sachs, and what were the so-called systemic risks associated with each of those payments? Secondly, what was the nature of those payments? Why were they overpaying Goldman Sachs and the other banks, Deutsche Bank and the others, with taxpayers' money? And then finally, why did they see no need to be transparent from the get-go? Now in a rage, now in a kind of a pitchfork and torches storm, these people are acting like they've got to turn the cards face up. But sound business practice, ethical practice, should have had them acting like that last summer. And even with a change in administration, I think we got off on the wrong foot. Why do they have to be pushed to conduct themselves in an honest manner?
We have been speaking with Robert Johnson, the co-author with Thomas Ferguson of the upcoming article in the International Journal of Political Economy, Too Big to Bail, The Paulson Put, Presidential Politics and the Global Financial Meltdown. Robert Johnson, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
A major newspaper account of Secretary of State Clinton's upcoming visit to Mexico speaks of mounting U.S. anxiety over cross-border violence stemming from fighting among Mexican drug cartels. It's not hard to see media themselves as the source of such anxiety. CNN's Wolf Blitzer recently posed the question for viewers, quote, could the killings, kidnappings, the assassinations, and all the drug war violence come to your city? Close quote. And the suggestion from that and numerous other segments has been yes. There is most certainly devastating drug war violence in Mexico, but are U.S. media giving us a clear picture of it or fear-mongering unhelpfully? Here to help us understand this story better is Laura Carlson, Program Director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. Her article, Drug War Doublespeak, appeared recently on Foreign Policy and Focus's website, among other places. She joins us now by phone from Mexico City. Welcome back to Counterspin, Laura Carlson.
Thanks for the invitation to be on the show.
Well,
Well, the Los Angeles Times had a pretty big piece March 15th entirely devoted to the firepower being acquired by Mexican drug traffickers, grenades, armor-piercing munitions, anti-tank rockets and explosives. They said Mexican law enforcement is grossly outgunned. Well, media coverage is not monolithic, but there does seem to be a lot of it of which the message seems to be things are horrifically lawless in Mexico, really spiraling out of control. And if you're watching cable news in particular, that violence is just about on your doorstep. Is that, let's just start with how reasonable an assessment is that?
This is an image that absolutely does not, is not borne out by the statistics or by the facts that we have on hand. There are two parts to the question, really. The first part is there major violence in Mexico? And the answer to that is undoubtedly yes. Between 2007 and 2008, the number of drug-related deaths more than doubled from around 2,500 to over 6,000 last year. And it seems to be a number that's rising all the time. We're at over 1,000 this year alone. So there are a constant barrage of media within Mexico that have to do with not only the number of these deaths, but also the graphicness of them. They're exemplary murders in the sense that they're decapitations and they're murders that are meant to send a signal to the rivaling drug cartels as they battle for routes and for markets in an intensified drug war here in Mexico City. But the other part of that question is how much of this is spilling over into the United States, and does Mexico itself represent a national security threat to the United States? And there is where the evidence breaks down and the hype begins. We've been looking at the crime rates in border communities and in counties along the border, and actually the violent crime rates have decreased over the past couple of years. When they cite this threat of spillover, what typically happens is the news story will begin talking about the violence in Mexico, and then it will jump to declarations by officials in the state or the counties saying that that violence could spill over to their own homes, but without any evidence that that's actually happened. Even in the hearings that have been taking place in Congress, the only kinds of evidence, hard evidence, that's come up about that kind of spillover are supposed threats to U.S. citizens coming out of Mexico that they will be chased across the border, but there are very few or if any incidents to be reported yet. People who are being treated in Texas hospitals for injuries incurred in Ciudad Juarez, and other very indirect measures of the supposed spillover threat. It's not entirely a problem of the U.S. media, of course. There have been a number of statements by very high-level officials, government officials, to the same effect, that Mexico could be one of the most serious national security threats to the United States today. And again, they're very rarely backed up with any kind of facts. So we're extremely concerned that what's happening here is a prelude to an even greater militarization of the border, which could, in fact, lead to the kind of conflict that they're trying to avoid.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I've seen that there has been some pushback. The Wall Street Journal reported that a number of border officials were rejecting Texas Governor Rick Perry's call for federal troops down at that border, saying that that's not necessary. And I heard Representative Loretta Sanchez on National Public Radio trying to kind of quell the idea that spillover violence was occurring now or that tourists to Mexico were in danger. But if that picture that doesn't jibe with the reality, if that hyper-violent spillover picture doesn't quite fit, who's being served by it? Who's pushing it? Who benefits from that?
Well, this is an excellent question now, because it's kind of the source of the worry. We do know that there's a lot of interest on the part of defense contractors and private security firms to get involved in the Mexican security business, both within Mexico and along the border. There already have been, of course, with the militarization of the border regarding undocumented workers and migrants, there have already been many multi-million-dollar contracts for the construction of the fence, the virtual fence, monitoring equipment, and that type of thing. So many of the firms that are probably going to see a reduction of their business in Iraq are beginning to look at Mexico as a new market. There have been meetings recently, and people who have attended the meetings have told me about this, that in fact it's considered a real new frontier for both private security firms who do the kind of training that are involved in measures like the Merida Initiative, the new aid package for military and police support coming from the United States to Mexico, and other types of measures that are being pushed now. So this is a very real economic force that's behind it. As far as the political, the major statements that are coming out are from people who are either former or present high-level officials with the Drug Enforcement Agency or with the military-associated agencies, the Department of Defense. This is probably more than a conspiracy theory, because I'm not really one to think that everything is thought out from the beginning. Sometimes a particular media message gets started and ends up snowballing. But one thing we do know about the way of that people approach problems with military training, because of their training, they tend to go immediately to approach as a solution. And that's what's happening with this drug scene, a real end of the power of drug cartels in Mexico. But instead, say, taking a public health approach to the illegal drug use and illegal drug trafficking and the entire problem as a whole, they are immediately taking this military approach that looks to enforcement and interdiction on the supply side as the solution. And that's in many ways what's triggered the violence here in Mexico.
Well, let me ask you finally and briefly, and as far as journalists go, how might journalists redirect or refocus their reporting in a way that might help the effort to, as I've gotten the indication from some reports, an effort on the ground to find a different approach?